This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What do Facebook and Groupon have in common? They're hugely popular, and on paper, they're worth billions. But there's a critical difference. Facebook relies on user-generated content, which costs next to nothing to produce. Groupon, on the other hand, requires a huge local sales army. And as we learn today, its future growth is going to cost a lot of money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at NovoNordisk-US.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Thanks for making us a part of your Wednesday, December the 29th. You don't have to spend a lot of time online lately before you run into an ad for Groupon. That online coupon promoter emails subscribers a daily deal in more than 300 markets around the world. It seems Google liked the concept so much it offered to buy Groupon for $6 billion. Groupon said no thanks and turned Google down. Apparently, you can make a lot of money selling coupons. But it turns out generating coupons is a labor-intensive business that eats up cash. And today comes word that Groupon needs to find other ways to raise the money it needs to grow the deal-a-day concept in new markets. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Groupon wants to raise up to $950 million, but it apparently doesn't want to go public, and it doesn't want to be bought by the likes of Google, so it's going to stay a private company but sell preferred shares. Scott Kessler's an equity analyst at Standard & Poor's.
Companies want the best of both worlds. They want to be able to control their own destinies and reap the financial rewards.
Groupon's only been around since 2008, and already it's got 35 million subscribers. So why does it need money? Deborah Kay is with innovation consulting firm Lucule. She says finding these deals takes time and money.
Groupon actually has to go out and create these offers. It has a much higher amount of employees than other companies like a Google or like a Facebook that really work on the power of the people itself.
That is the power of their unpaid users. Groupon deals can be pretty impressive. Pay $25 and you can spend double that at Nordstrom Rack. But local merchants can end up losing money on the deal. Susie Sandberg with online marketing firm PM Digital says some of her clients have balked after their Groupon experience.
We've had people say all they want is the deal. They just come and get the deal. You never see them again. They only buy the value of the deal.
If merchants don't sign up, Groupon's popularity could wane. The real threat could come if Facebook or other social media players were to get into the mobile retail sales offer business. Again, here's innovation consultant Deborah Kay.
What we're going to start to see is a kind of cost chaos of targeted offers. I mean, there's going to be so many different offers and so many different deals.
So many offers that Groupon may wish it had access to those famous Google algorithms it turned down. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
This year, China beat out the U.S. as the largest market for cars. Sales have been stacking up like a Beijing traffic jam for a gain of upwards of 30% in China this year, while demand elsewhere has been sluggish. Next week, though, Chinese buyers of small vehicles will lose a big government tax incentive. On top of that, Beijing City Hall is cutting the number of license plates issued to reduce congestion. What might that mean for American automakers angling for a piece of the action in China? Marketplace's Elisa Roth has been looking into that.
Of the big three U.S. automakers, GM is the one that's most likely to feel the changes. It does much more business in China than Ford or Chrysler does. But even the combined effects of the tax increase and the driving restrictions in Beijing probably won't do too much harm. Nicholas Lardy studies China at the Peterson Institute, which is a nonpartisan think tank. He says at some point, the growth rate for Chinese car sales will probably slow down. But even with all the recent growth, only a small percentage of Chinese households own cars. So the market still has plenty of potential.
They could have fairly significant growth for many years to come if the underlying growth of the economy continues to be very robust and family incomes continue to rise. In other words, there'll be more and more families every year who reach an income level in which they could afford to buy a car.
GM is predicting its sales will go up 15% next year. Volkswagen is predicting increases of 10 to 15%. Marianne Keller is an auto industry consultant. She says what's happening is that China's car market is finally normalizing after the government artificially pumped it up for years. She says she doesn't see a lot of immediate risk for foreign car makers in China.
The risks for them are probably 5, 6, 7 years from now when local Chinese companies get their act together and make competitive cars.
And right now, some people say China's decision to get rid of the tax incentives on small cars could have a silver lining for companies like GM and VW. It'll make the prices for their mostly larger cars more competitive. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
After a couple of days of mixed results, stocks edged into the green today. Details when we do the numbers. PepsiCo has got a new product it'll be testing in a month. It's called Tropolis. It's a food snack made of fruit, but it's pureed, so you can also drink it. We've seen this before. Think Go-Gurt, but it seems like a trend in the making, so we turn to beverage industry consultant Tom Perko. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So Pepsi's chairwoman Indra Nooyi was talking earlier this month about the opportunity to snackify beverages and drinkify snacks. What category does this fall in, do you think?
She says, I hope they change the terms. It's really interesting because this isn't really about a product. This is about a company that has been lurching toward the food business in a different way and separating itself from Coca-Cola. The war of these two giant companies to seize world domination for beverages has really changed because consumers are no longer drinking carbonated soft drinks the way they once did. Now, you know, the great fear with obesity and all of that with children is forcing them to try to find ways to move not only toward nutritional products, but really toward food.
So what do you think makes a snackable drink?
You know, companies have been doing this in Europe and in Russia and other places for a long time. The main thing is really convenience. If you are in this business, you want to get something into a consumer's hand and get them to put it down as fast as possible. And these products, it's a whole lot easier if you have something that is a combination of drink and a beverage where you don't have to peel the banana or literally chew the apple. So you get the same kind of satisfaction from getting fruit or a dairy sort of product in a form that's sort of between a food and a beverage. So it's convenience, you know. But American consumers are too lazy to chew. So, you know, so you have to find something where they can have their apple or their pear in a semi-liquid form.
Now, you're serious about this. You think that cutting down on chewing is going to save us some time here?
No, and wouldn't chewing be the best exercise as well? No, the psychological keys here, and it's really important because, again, we're moving from a paradigm of soft drinks not being good for you. We're moving toward things that have other values and other nutritional values. So we're trying to move beverages more in the direction of food simply because of there being a more positive value attached. If that's the case, how do you deliver food but with all the convenience of beverage? You're seeing it now with this kind of product.
Yeah, talking to moms around here, it does seem squeezable yogurt and applesauce in tubes is pretty popular in households with kids. But why do you think consumers are, if you'll excuse the expression, eating this up?
It's new. It's faddish. You know, we're in an era now in which you go to a park and you see mothers gathering around another mother who's given her child a soft drink and saying, evil, bad, you're harming your child. Mm-hmm. These kinds of drinks sort of run around that and say, this is nutritional. So you're still delivering sugar, but you're also delivering some of the benefits. Hybridizing food and beverage, which is really sort of what this is in a way clever, but it's also a way of dealing with consumers' heads.
We are what we eat. Tom Perko is president of BevMark, a beverage industry consultancy. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed it.
It seems appropriate to borrow a line from Charles Dickens this time of year, as in we've got one of those best of times, worst of times things going on in America right now. So says commentator Robert Reich. He's worried that our winter of hope might just give way to a spring of despair for many Americans.
What will happen to the U.S. economy in 2011? Well, that depends on which economy you're talking about. If you're referring to profits of big corporations from Wall Street, next year could be fabulous. But if you're referring to average American workers, not so good. You see, there are two economies in America right now, and they're going in different directions. That's because America's big businesses depend less and less on U.S. sales and workers. In 2010, they racked up giant profits by selling in China, India, and other fast-growing countries, and also by keeping U.S. payrolls down, doing more with fewer American workers. Expect the same in 2011. General Motors is now making more cars in China than in the U.S., and two-thirds of its total sales are coming from abroad. Walmart isn't doing especially well in America, but Walmart International is booming. General Electric is keeping its payrolls down in the U.S., but plans to invest $500 million in Brazil and hire 1,000 Brazilians and invest $2 billion in China. Corporate America is in a V-shaped recovery, which is great news for investors and everyone whose savings are mainly in financial instruments. Also great news for executives and Wall Street traders. But most American workers are in an L-shaped recovery. That's bad news for main streets and small businesses. Also a bad omen for home prices and sales, and everyone whose savings are mainly in their homes. And it doesn't bode well for U.S. unemployment, which is likely to remain high. In other words, whether 2011 is a great year economically depends which economy you're in, the one that's rising with the profits of big business in Wall Street, or the one that's still struggling with few jobs and lousy wages. Here's to a happy and healthy new year for you, even if it's not all that prosperous.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week, it's commentator David Frum's turn. Your turn to talk back is anytime you want to at marketplace.org. Coming up, doing business the old-fashioned way without risking all the fancy frills.
So you're not also into the, like, speculative wine futures and things like that?
No. No. I'm very careful where the money goes.
But first, let's do the numbers. Another quiet trading day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 9 points, just under 0.1%, to close at 11,585. The NASDAQ rose 4 points, 0.1%, to finish at 2,666. The S&P 500 ticked up 1 point. You guessed it, 0.1%, to close at 1,259. The markets aren't doing badly, though. The Dow is up more than 11% this year. The S&P 500 is up 13%. The NASDAQ is up more than 17%. Molycorp gained 6.75%. Seems that China's plans to cut back on exports of minerals needed for cell phones, magnets, and much else got investors buying stock in the U.S. rare earth mining company. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for November. Helping Californians get around, the Arroyo Seco Parkway officially opened on December 30, 1940. The designated National Scenic Byway connects Pasadena and Los Angeles and is considered the oldest freeway in the West. We have a lot more of them now. And basketball player LeBron James turns 26. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdo. It's going to be a nervous new year across the Atlantic. Europe's wobbly economies need to raise more than $2 trillion to avoid further financial troubles. Question is, will there be any takers for Europe's debts on the global money markets? Greece needed to be bailed out in May, and Ireland followed with hat in hand this month. Now anxiety lingers among the nations that share the euro as a common currency. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us from London to review a troubling year for the euro. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Bob.
The euro was 10 years old at the beginning of 2010. It had been widely hailed as a big success. Some even said it was a haven of stability during the banking crisis and the recession. What went wrong in 2010?
Right. Yes, they were speaking a little too soon. What happened in 2010 was the penny dropped. The truth finally dawned. When they created this project more than a decade ago, they thought they could have one currency, one central bank, one set of interest rates for 16 very different economies without at the same time having one fiscal system. That is, one system of raising taxes and spending public money. You can't. It doesn't work very well. And 2010 proved it.
I think it was more than a penny that dropped, Stephen. Why doesn't it work? What was the problem?
Well, if you take the example of Greece, runs up huge debts, can't pay its way, who helps it out? If it was part of this one system of taxing and spending, the money would, apart from the fact Greece may not have got into this mess in the first place, the money would flow automatically from the stronger to the weaker parts of the union. Without that, what happened? You get a lot of friction and ill feeling about who picks up the tab? Who bails out Greece, especially in Germany, since Germany paid the lion's share of the bailouts?
Now you've hit on what I think perhaps is the biggest threat to the survival of the euro. Does it come from Germany?
Yes, it does. I think so. The German people feel betrayed. I mean, they very much resented having to bail out Greece and Ireland. They don't want a fiscal union. They were told, actually, at the time the euro was launched, there was more likely to be famine in Bavaria than a bailout. The phrase that the Germans very often use is a transfer union or a transfer society, as in transferring money from their pockets into the pockets of their, as they see it, feckless neighbours. Here's German economist and former member of the European Investment Bank, Horst Feuerstein.
We don't want to open the floodgates and have a transfer society that the Germans will transfer to these economies forever. And that is not in the interest of the Germans, and it's not in the interest of the people who get the transfers.
Okay, if we see the German public opposed to this transfer union or this fiscal union, doesn't that mean the euro is doomed, as we like to say here in America, united we stand, divided we fall, that sort of thing?
No, not necessarily. It means the euro certainly could collapse, especially if big countries like Spain or, heaven forbid, Italy get into trouble and have to be bailed out. It's much more likely that the euro will stagger on and muddle through because there are things to bear in mind here. German banks have lent hundreds of billions of euros to these weaker eurozone countries like Spain, Ireland and so on. If the euro broke up, that debt would become unpayable largely, and that would mean big bankruptcies in Germany. There's another point, too. There would be huge technical problems if the currency broke up. Think of all those vending machines that would have to be scrapped, all those computers that would have to be reprogrammed if European Monetary Union, EMU as it's called, fell apart. Andrew Hilton is head of the CSFI think tank.
There would be enormous problems, logistical problems, in dismantling EMU. EMU was specifically set up with no exit mechanism. And inevitably, if it broke up, there would be chaos in the markets for a while.
But he adds these things do happen nevertheless, and big cross-border currency unions, which include independent countries, rarely last for very long.
Mm. Well, a very happy and prosperous New Year to you, Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London.
Thank you, Bob, and the same to you.
It's Wednesday, time to go through the mailbox and see what you have to say.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
The new U.S. Census numbers came out last week. Peter Boyle of Mount Gilead, Ohio, heard us talk about counties with growing populations that may get more political representation. But don't forget that government aid is determined by population, and he worries that will mean more demand on already tight budgets.
You know, down here, there's almost nothing in the way of new jobs. The growing number of people have run out of everything and are one step away from being homeless. If governments can't put people to work and cut funding for the truly needy, I fear that there will be little to rejoice about in the near future.
Several of you were upset about our report on California allowing strawberry farmers to use a pesticide called methyl iodide. Leslie Moran of Silver Springs, Nevada, says we left out what she calls the hidden costs of agrochemical farming.
Health damage to people, pets, and wild animals, chemical contamination of our environment and its link to global pandemics, social and water resources being polluted and depleted, destruction of fragile ecosystems, and global biodiversity.
On a lighter note, Peter Rednauer of San Francisco was excited about our story on the making of the modern classic Christmas Wrapping by the Waitresses.
I've been listening to that song my whole life. It's a year older than I am, because my dad made Christmas mixtapes almost every year of the 80s. And still to this day, one of my favorite parts of the season is me and my dad sharing the new weird Christmas music we find.
We also noted how holiday shoppers may hear more thank yous from store employees. Paula Hentz of Denver was surprised that the retail industry is catching on to a strategy that nonprofits have used for a long time.
As a fundraising professional, I know that one of the most important steps one must take with a donor is a timely and sincere thank you. Fundraising efforts will likely fall flat without them.
And we'll take that cue to say thank you for sending in your thoughts. We look forward to hearing what you have to say. Just go to marketplace.org and look for the link that says contact. Ever since the financial crisis hit, there's been soul-searching about the role of exotic financial instruments and just how many of those fancy, often risky investments does a business need just to keep afloat. In our series, Economy 4.0, special correspondent David Brancaccio has been following the quest for a financial system that better serves more people. Today, David visits a global business in mid-America that's been doing just fine without any derivatives, hedges, or even a big loan.
Go back to the furthest recesses of your long-term memory and see if you can identify this sound.
Get him mixed up with me. He's typing on a typewriter. He's never made the transition to the computer age yet. And we bought him a laptop, hoping we could teach him how to do the internet, and he just has no interest. So
Jack McGinnis is talking about the boss, his father, Leroy, CEO of McGinnis Wood Products of Cuba, Missouri. They are coopers, manufacturers of barrels for vineyards and whiskey distilleries around the world. They use acres of wooden slats made from white oak, but no email, no texting, and no fancy financial footwork here.
We don't owe nothing. We don't borrow. We haven't for many, many years.
You don't borrow money for this?
I don't borrow money. Since 1992 was the last debt we had. I had $1 million CD in the bank.
$1 million certificate of deposit, a CD. I mean, surely you could have put $1 million into something more fancy.
Actually, at the time, we had about $5 million in the bank and just didn't need it. And so we just got a CD with it. The interest was good.
I couldn't interest you in a hedge fund. I couldn't interest you in a set of derivatives or something.
No.
Paul Volcker, the former Federal Reserve Chairman and now head of President Obama's Economic Recovery Board, has asked for any proof that financial innovation has helped the economy. The one useful example of financial engineering in recent decades, Volcker famously said, is the automated teller machine. McGinnis will use an ATM, but only to get money that he has made, not borrowed.
I guess because I grew up in the Depression. And I remember 1932, and we lost the home, we lost the farm, the cattle died in the field. But I've never forgot that. I still live in that period of time.
A tongue of flame cooks the inside of a new barrel. The resulting carbon lining helps mellow whiskey over time. McGinnis may not believe in leverage, but he does believe in growth, slow, steady growth, over time. He had $18 million in sales this year and is shooting for $20 million next. I had visited his factory exactly 10 years ago, and since then, McGinnis bought some expensive new kilns for drying the oak, and there's a new building so whiskey and wine barrels can be made separately. Over the decade, he's doubled his employees to 135 people. This conservative approach is not crazy or sentimental.
That's actually pretty smart.
Dan Gross, economics editor at Yahoo Finance, says other bigger American firms have only recently figured out what guys in the heartland, like McGinnis, have known all along.
Large corporations today are hoarding cash, right? They are paying down their debt if they're smart. They're keeping a huge amount of cash on hand to ward off any liquidity problems in the future. So this is what big businesses are doing, too.
Where McGinnis has been expansive is in cultivating his global markets. Wine barrels for Spain were very strong this year, McGinnis says. Given the euro crisis, that may not continue, but he's expecting Chile and Australia to take up the slack. And there's always U.S. bourbon. Just back from visiting customers at distilleries in Kentucky, McGinnis tells a veteran driver they may need a new semi-truck to haul new business.
We're going to be busy.
We're going to be real busy.
You can't build long-term growth on financial wizardry with gains on paper and not in the real world. That's the view of Bill Gross, the respected chief of the investment firm PIMCO, in his letter to clients this month. America, Gross writes, needs to make things, not paper. Things maybe like barrels made of American white oak manufactured without much in the way of financial engineering.
So you're not also into the, speculative wine futures and things like that?
No. I'm very careful where the money goes.
In Cuba, Missouri, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
To read David's Economy 4.0 blog and follow his exploration of better ways to handle the economy, check out our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping investors save for retirement since 1937. For the latest retirement news, you can talk to your advisor, then visit RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A white Christmas in Wilmington, North Carolina, is about to turn into green for customers who did their holiday shopping at a local jewelry store. The owner of Perry's Emporium promised refunds for everything bought at his store between November 26th and December 11th, if more than 3 inches of snow fell on Christmas Day. Well, the area was blanketed by more than 6 inches, so customers will get their money back. Alan Perry figures the total payout will be around $400,000. He says he paid for an insurance policy that will cover the refunds, and now he's thinking about betting on how much snow will fall on Valentine's Day. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 9 points, just under 0.1%. The Nasdaq rose 4 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 ticked up 1 point, 0.1%. Vahan Baladuni, Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, promoting bicycle commuting in New York has not been smooth coasting.
You know, they want the city to look like Copenhagen. They want it to look like... And this is Manhattan. It's Manhattan. It's not Copenhagen.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can cycle back here and join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.